Okay, so my name is Eric Raton. I teach philosophy at Oklahoma State University, and for the last dozen years or so, I've been very interested in and involved with controversies about the doctrine of hell. And my discussion partner, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Catherine Jin. I teach religion at Princeton University, and I am interested in the concept of hell in American history. So we're approaching this from different perspectives. Should be an interesting conversation.
And what's triggering the conversation is a book that recently came out, written by a very popular evangelical preacher and best-selling author, Rob Bell. It was a book that triggered quite a bit of controversy even before it came out, and it even managed to get on the cover of Time magazine. So we're going to talk a little bit about the controversy around the book, and particularly around the doctrine of hell and the rival doctrine of universalism, which is the doctrine that all people are saved, at least ultimately. And who knows, we'll talk a little bit about why hell matters, and we may say some things about Osama bin Laden. Is he in hell?
It's a great question, keeping it fresh. So I guess we should start maybe with this question of why Bell is generating so much controversy. We've both written about this and we've both pointed out, and as have a number of other commentators, that not much of what Bell is saying is actually new. Right.
Right. I mean, it's really, when I got the book, I was surprised at how little of it. I liked his eloquence. I liked the way that he presented his ideas, but it's
Right.
very old ideas. They've been around for a very long time. They've been debated for a very long time, and his position is hardly the most out there controversial position that one could take on the doctrine of hell. But he certainly, even before the book came out, generated an enormous backlash.
Yeah, I completely agree. I agree with the style of the writing. I think what is new about it is the way that he presents it for a current audience. And for those who haven't read the book, there are, passages that are essentially poetic, very short, brief, pithy statements.
Well, that was one of the things that I noticed as I was leafing through the book. It looked like it was a book of poetry, and I mean, he set it up almost
Right.
in this poetic way, and that
Or scriptures, maybe.
right, yeah, almost right, yeah. But yeah, before the book even came out, what really sparked the controversy was this, I think, really very effective little video promotional clip for the book, in which Rob Bell shares this little anecdote that's actually shared at the start of the book itself, about some art multimedia thing that they had at his church, and someone had quoted something from Gandhi in one of the art pieces, and someone else had attached somehow a note to that art piece saying, "Reality check, Gandhi is in hell." And the video clip has Bell present this anecdote and say, "Gandhi in hell? Really?" And then he starts to gesture towards what sounds like it might be a universalist position. That is, he gestures towards the idea that that maybe God saves everyone. Maybe there's no one who is ultimately damned forever. And this suggestion was enough to spark this really strong reaction. You get this blog piece by Justin Taylor, who is he the editor of Crossways? Is that right?
I, yeah.
And then that basically is shocked that bad theology is being preached from the pulpit, and then you get what I call excommunication by tweet.
I love that.
from John Piper, right. Who...
farewell, know, so, Rob Bell.
Yeah, farewell, Rob Bell, it says. And, that, right. And this became huge on Twitter in the days after the promotional material was released.
Well, do you think it's the social media that's turning this into such a big deal? Is it, you know, the fact that people have so much more access nowadays to debate this kind of issue with people that they don't even know?
You know, I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about that in part in connection with the article that you wrote for Religion Dispatches. You started with talking about Carlton Pearson, who he's here in Oklahoma, and I was here in Oklahoma at the time when the controversy broke around him. Carlton Pearson was this preacher in Tulsa, headed up a mega church, very charismatic preacher.
Trained by Oral Roberts.
Yes, he was trained by, and the Oral Roberts University bussed students out to his church on every Sunday. He even ran for mayor of Tulsa.
Wow, I wasn't aware of that.
And so he was a very prominent figure, especially in the evangelical Pentecostal community in Tulsa. And then he had this awakening that as he was wrestling with Scripture and his Christian faith, he became convinced that Jesus, when he died on the cross, died for the sins of all humanity and thereby paid the penalty for all human sin. And this meant that no one would go to hell forever, that all would be saved.
He had a very similar awakening moment to Rob Bell, not in the Gandhi issue, but he said, you know, in his interview, he gave an interview on NPR, I believe, that he was watching TV and watching the suffering of people in Rwanda. And, you know, looking at that and seeing that hell exists on earth, that there's so much suffering on this earth, how can we believe that there is a place of eternal torment after death? And Rob Bell writes similarly about, not just think about after death. Let's also think about what's happening in this world, you know, how we can
Bell
bring heaven
does
to this world. Yeah.
Very eloquently talk about, yes, I believe in hell. I see it here on earth. It's reality that we're dealing with. And so... but you find some very strong parallels between Carlton Pearson and Rob Bell. Carlton Pearson was about a decade earlier in the early, what's that decade called that we just got out of, the noughties? I don't know. we haven't named it. It bothers me. I'm going to call it the noughties.
The noughties. I like that.
Yes. We'll call it the noughties. And so in the early noughties, Carlton Pearson... very similar situation. He comes out clearly as a universalist, and he is shunned. His church shrivels up and practically withers away. He's still around, and he still heads up this church, but it's much smaller. He's really lost a lot of the ground and the prestige that he had. Bell, the reaction seems to be profoundly different.
Yeah, well, there was no Is Hell Dead cover story for Carlton Pearson in Time magazine, right? It just never generated the same national media firestorm that's come around Bell and his book.
Right, and I get the sense almost that Bell's popularity and prestige and influence has grown as a result of this controversy in his case, which is a very different... very different thing than what happened with Carlton Pearson. I'm wondering, as a historian, if you have any thoughts on why. And maybe it is the social media. Maybe.
I think that's part of it. I mean, in the piece that I wrote, I also mentioned that there have been a number of other universalist controversies in the past as well. And what this current moment most reminds me of is the universalist controversy in the late 18th century, when the first universalists you know, came from Europe to America and tried to set up a universalist denomination. This set off a similar media frenzy. Now, obviously, there wasn't Facebook or Twitter back then, but if you look at the newspapers, there's very similar, you know, arguments back and forth, anger, hostility, sarcasm, this kind of thing. And I think part of the reason is that we're living in a somewhat similar moment of anxiety. I think that's part of it. I think in the late 18th century, there's anxiety over whether the nation is going to survive. It's a very, you know, new country at the moment. It's a country without a monarch, a country founded on the premise of virtue. And so the question is, if you get rid of hell, what's going to keep people in line? In the present day, I think there's a similar kind of anxiety. It's not an anxiety that suffuses the entire population. I think it's an anxiety that's expressed among a particular segment of the population that expresses it very loudly. I think it's a sign of recent polarization, political polarization, much of which follows religious lines.
I wonder if also maybe the social media that we have today has in effect made this much larger world, mm-hmm. much more populous world, in some ways smaller and hence more similar to the world in which these controversies exploded in the late 18th century.
That's possible? Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think that's definitely possible. The controversy is reaching more people. It's definitely more people. It's a broader geography, but there are more means of getting to ordinary people. But at the same time, I wonder though, if it's really at base a controversy that's been generated by the media, and whether ordinary people are really as invested in it as the media claims.
but at the same time, the media was responding, it seems to me, to the explosion in the social media. Mm-hmm. The explosion of ordinary people discussing this on Twitter is what brought this to the attention of the established media. And right. so they're responding to something that's really happening. It may just be a segment of the population. I don't know mm-hmm. how broad the concern is about hell across various demographics, but still.
Right. There's high numbers, high poll numbers. I think from 2008, the Pew survey gave, 59% of Americans believing in hell. And a Gallup poll recently gave 70%. So that's, these are pretty big numbers. These are still majorities. So I think you are right that there are a number of people, ordinary people, who are invested in this. But I wonder if it's a cycle where, you know, ordinary people generate this, these responses on Twitter and the social media. The media then picks it up, and then it just, you know, continues in this cycle of feedback, essentially. You know, it's been a while since Bell's book came out. And here we are talking about it a month and a half later.
Well, and what's interesting to me is, here's a question. Would the mm-hmm. book have generated the kind of firestorm that it did if there hadn't been the suggestive promotional materials that didn't spell out Bell's actual position? Mm. Because right. If you read the actual book, he starts out saying, talking about hell, and he says, I think there is a hell. And hell is the state that prevails when, you know, people turn away from the good, turn away from the beautiful, turn away from the true, turn away from mm-hmm. God. Mm-hmm. And when they seek to live their lives in alienation from all that's good, they create a hell for themselves here on earth, and they can make life hellish for those within their power. Mm-hmm. And he thinks there's no reason to suppose this kind of choice can't also be made after death, and therefore that there's going to be a hell after death. But then he raises the question of, well, could this choice be made forever?
If you can make that choice... For hell after death, can you also make the choice for heaven after death as well?
Right. And, I mean, this, there are many universalists who agree with Bell that there is a hell. Mm-hmm. What universalists deny is not hell. What they deny is an eternal hell, a hell right. that is a final, endless condition for some human souls. What universalists argue is that that eventually all will be saved, even though some maybe have to go to hell, go through hell first to
get there. A purgation process, essentially.
Right. And and Bell is open to that possibility.
Yes, for sure.
He at one point expresses very clearly that we just can't know mm-hmm. whether all will be saved. He's an agnostic on the issue of
eternal. He definitely is, yeah. I think part of it is that he's rejecting the eternity of hell. He's also rejecting a particular kind of hell. Right? This is, there's no fire and brimstone, even in the hell that he affirms might be possible. Right? This is not.
Right. And it's pretty clear that hell is not viewed by Bell as a punishment imposed by God.
Right.
This
right.
fire or suffering that God imposes as a punishment for sin. Rather, if for those who endure hell, they endure it because they have made a choice to mm-hmm. exist in alienation from God. And this is, of course, a very old idea. And you find in the 20th century, C.S. Lewis in The Great Divorce expressing right. a similar idea.
Right.
C.S. Lewis is, of course, a hero of evangelicals. Mm-hmm. So Bell, in reiterating Lewis's idea, is not doing anything that should outrage John Piper, unless Piper is outraged by C.S. Lewis, and if he is, he probably doesn't want to be too public about that.
Yeah, well, I think part of the outrage stems from something that you wrote about in your piece for Religion Dispatches, is that it's an outrage over the possibility of doubt, right? It's an outrage over the possibility that we might not be entirely right about the way that we read the Bible. Right, and so the fact that this evangelical pastor, Rob Bell, is expressing doubts over commonly accepted evangelical views of the afterlife is what really has them up in arms. Do you think that's fair?
Right. I think that, I mean, this is what I was arguing in my piece, and I was associating it to something in my own experience. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, I was giving a talk about this... the last book I wrote, which was on the New Atheists, to a group of Christian faculty. And in the course of the discussion period afterward, the issue of universalism came up, and I basically came out as a universalist. And this one person in the audience started attacking this and laying out a position that was, you know, clearly what I call hellist. Then I said, well, you know, I disagree with that. And he immediately shot back, then you disagree with God.
Right, right.
And this is what I was hearing from Justin Taylor and John Piper and other conservative critics of Bell and the immediate mm-hmm. Explosion of the controversy. If you disagree with us, you disagree with God. There was this right. identification of their own theological position with God
right.
That entailed that challenging them was challenging God himself. Mm-hmm. And that's what I take to be sort of the essence of fanaticism.
Yeah, and I had a question about that fanaticism mm-hmm. or the labeling of that as fanaticism. What is the difference between fanaticism and conviction, I guess?
Yeah. For me, the difference is how hermetically sealed your beliefs are from criticism, and how mm-hmm. The fanatic has mechanisms in place that protect their beliefs from any kind of criticism. And not only that, but criticism is labeled as this dangerous force. This evil,
yeah.
right?
That's and, true, right.
Right, and so the critic, by criticizing, is a sinner, right? Because
right.
they
right.
are...
But for some, that's the very essence of belief, right, is the idea that you are, you, that you've made this choice, that you have thought about it rationally, right? I think most people who do believe in the concept of heaven and hell in a way that Rob Bell rejects have made a choice to do so. And once they've made that choice, then they do believe that it's important, that this is the essence of their belief, is to seal it off from criticism. And if you really do believe in heaven and hell as ultimate realities, then it makes sense that they would then, you know, depict everyone else as not falling within. But I'm not sure that I would call that fanaticism necessarily. I think it's well, belief carried out to its logical conclusion, if you really do believe in these concepts.
Well, I mean, is it possible to believe something and yet be accepting of people who believe otherwise? Is it possible to really be convinced of something and to have made a commitment of faith to something and yet be open to considering seriously the criticisms of others? It seems to me that it is.
I think it's possible, but I don't think I don't think it holds for everyone. I think if you accept certain premises, if you accept the premise that disagreeing with your belief system will send a person to hell, then no, it isn't possible.
Well, of course. And yeah. I think that someone who invokes this idea that believing other than I do is a guarantee of damnation have mm-hmm. invoked the kind of ideology that I associate with fanaticism. It's the kind of ideology that hermetically seals your belief from criticism, that cuts you off from people with different ideas or viewpoints. And that's what I think is the essence of fanaticism. Mm. If you cut yourself off from engagement in a thoughtful, respectful way with others through a belief system that is that's characterized by these self-defense mechanisms, mm-hmm. then I think you're a fanatic. But if you have conviction that is a matter of faith, and as a matter of faith you recognize that this is not a matter of knowledge, that you could be wrong, but you mm-hmm. have made a life choice, but others might not have made the same life choice, that seems to me it's still possible for that to be genuine conviction, mm-hmm. But it doesn't have the pernicious effects that I think what I call fanaticism has in terms of separating people, dividing people, and preventing.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's fair, but I wonder if that's a modern way of framing the issue, because I think, according to your definition, I think we might have to say that there were a lot of fanatics in this nation's past who did some pretty important things, you know, in the name of keeping.
Well, I don't think that fanaticism is necessarily a bar to being a good person in many other ways, but I think it is itself a vice. I don't think it's a vice that poisons the well of a person totally.
Right. Right.
So, I mean, I think I'm prepared to accept that consequence. I'm prepared to accept that in American history there may have been a lot of fanatics out there, and a lot of fanatics who were very admirable in very many ways.
And I think in some ways, because of their, as you define it, because of their fanaticism, because they had this worldview that's in which there was something ultimate for which they were fighting, you know, this drove them in many respects. So if you look at the slavery controversy, you know, the idea that slavery was such an immense sin that that you couldn't possibly believe that there wasn't a hell to right the sin in the afterlife, you know, this drove many people to oppose slavery. So I think it connects to one of the larger, you know, non-historical questions about hell, which is why people want it, why they need it. And, you know, this question of justice, is it necessary to have an eternal hell after death in order to right the wrongs on earth, is, I think, a pretty timeless question.
Right. Well, I mean, this, of course, ties in with current events because, when the other night I was sitting at the table with my wife when she was scrolling through Facebook on her BlackBerry and suddenly announced, Osama bin Laden's dead. And then she started reading updates from her Facebook friends, and there were a surprising number of them that referenced hell. Right now, yeah. Bin Laden is rotting in hell. Now, boy, isn't he surprised? Instead of a bunch mm-hmm. of virgins, he's facing, you know, hellfire. He's gonna roast baby.
Right. Same.
You know?
Same with Twitter. I wrote down one of my favorites, right? Before Osama travels to hell, he will have to remove his shoes, discard all liquids, and be subject to an invasive pat-down. Right. The ultimate ironic reversal.
Right. Well, I mean, this raises the question, what function is that serving?
Right.
Why is the doctrine of hell invoked in this kind of situation? And it, you know, clearly, at least in some of these invectives, it has something to do with a drive for retributive justice, a drive mm-hmm. for exacting vengeance, or maybe this notion that it would just not be fair for someone who's
it's
that
evil. It's the flip
evil.
Side of the Gandhi question, right? Is Gandhi in hell? Is Osama in heaven?
Right. Go ahead.
Oh, it's easier to, I mean, the Gandhi in hell question, I think, generates a lot. Well, actually, I don't know. Is Osama in heaven? I guess if you added the modifier, maybe will Osama eventually be in heaven? I wonder if that would make it more palatable to.
Right. And this is what, I mean, I think people often miss with universalism. Now, I'm not sure Rob Bell is a universalist, because he at one point claims that we can't know what people will choose in the afterlife. We just have to, but he thinks that God so loves creatures that he has to give them their freedom.
Love wins.
To make a choice.
Right.
But, even if we look at someone who's more clearly a Christian universalist, someone like, myself, but someone like Robin Perry, who wrote The Evangelical Universalist,
mm-hmm.
Under a pseudonym, Gregory MacDonald. He is clearly convinced that all will eventually be saved,
right.
But he does not, he's not thereby committed to the idea that Osama bin Laden is going to, you know, immediately at the moment of death, fly into God's loving embrace.
Exactly.
Because he shares the idea that there are impediments to loving relationship, impediments that lie in the character of Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden would have to, if at least if my understanding of ethics is right, he would need to fundamentally transform his entire worldview and his self-definition in order to be able to accept the good.
Mm-hmm.
Because, or at least as I see it, there's nothing good about what Osama bin Laden did, about the campaign of terror that he oversaw. It was utterly wicked, but he lived in the grip of an ideology that held this campaign of terror and violence and death to be a glorious service to God. Now imagine
service that would send a person to heaven, and this is you know, something that a number of columnists have pointed out. If we don't say that Osama bin Laden is in hell, then, you know, are we justifying his theology that holds that, you know, killing people in the name of this ideology will send a person to heaven?
Well, but I mean, the thing is that if someone's in the grip of this kind of ideology, and if, as I believe, there is no truth to it, then then that ideology is an impediment, a fundamental impediment to any kind of authentic relationship with the good. And if God is the ultimate good, then a relationship of loving union with God is fundamentally impeded by Osama bin Laden's ideological commitment to that drove this campaign of violence and terror. So what someone like Robin Perry, I think, would say, and what I would certainly say, and what Rob Bell, I think, would say, is that Osama bin Laden can't have a loving relationship right. with the good so long as he has this set of distorted and destructive ideological convictions that lead him to see the evil as good and the good as evil, right? He can't rush into the arms of the good if the lenses through which he sees the world label the good as wicked, right? And vice versa. This inverted worldview has to first be shattered.
Right. Now, but the question, difference is that Christian universalists see that there still is a chance for him.
Right. The Christian universalist is going to hold that this ideology can be shattered. Now, part of what the universalist has to wrestle with is this sense that, well, let's suppose it is shattered. He still deserves to fry, right? And if we accept Bell's thinking, what we have to accept is that if this ideology breaks down through the experience of really being in the hell that ideology creates,
yeah.
If that happens, then for Bell, yes, Osama bin Laden would then be saved.
Eventually,
and,
right.
Right. So if the ideology breaks down, then...
I think what they also have to wrestle with is not just the question of retributive justice or, you know, he deserves to fry, but it's also the question of, you know, if death is not the final, this is what people who believe in hell and who would oppose Rob Bell would argue. You know, if death is not final, then what's to stop people from behaving like Osama bin Laden on Earth, right? So it's not just about retribution, but it's also about, it is very much about this life too. What's to stop people from murdering? What's to stop them from, you know, committing atrocious crimes, knowing that death is not the ultimate end, that there still is a chance for them afterwards? You know, how do you think Rob Bell would respond to that? I mean, he's so focused on this life, on creating heaven and hell in this life. But...
Right, and that's the essence, I think, of Rob Bell's answer. He wants to say that you don't need some otherworldly system of rewards and punishments to justify living your life in tune with the good now and avoiding wickedness, because choosing the good now is choosing to live in heaven now and to start living in this intrinsically rewarding and satisfying and uplifting and humanizing way. All right. So we're back.
Apologies. Sorry. So we were talking about the question of this life and whether you need the fear of another life in order to make this life into a good one, right? You said that Rob
right.
Bell would respond that, you know, we should choose the good on earth. We should choose to live in heaven on earth because, you know, it can start now. We shouldn't have to wait because of the promise of a better life or the fear of punishment after death, right? And that this
right.
should stop people from committing murders or acting like Osama bin Laden. I think that depends on a pretty optimistic view of human nature.
I think Bell's point is not that, I don't see it that way. What I would say is that he has a view about the relationship between moral goodness and a rewarding life, between moral goodness and happiness. I think he has an idea that because we live in a world that, according to him, is under the sovereign care of a God whose essence is love, to choose the good is to choose to live in the arms of this loving relationship, and it brings an immediate reward. To choose wickedness is to choose to live in an intrinsically defective and unhappy state. So
I agree, but don't, I mean, some people choose their immediate pleasure, right, which is a form of wickedness to others as part of their lives on earth, right? That if they're, one person's good is not necessarily another's. And
I mean, there's what's controversial about Bell's position and this broader position is the idea that that a necessary condition for a truly satisfying life is to be a genuinely caring, loving person. There are some people who don't buy that. There are some people who think, no, you can be a selfish bastard and you'll be still as capable of happiness, because what's important for happiness is the satisfaction of rampant running desires, and the bigger a bastard you are, the better equipped you are to ruthlessly go after your desires.
And you'll eventually end up in heaven.
Well, the I mean, the issue here, I don't think, is about heaven and hell so much as our conception of the good life, our conception of what makes for a life that is intrinsically meaningful and rewarding. If you believe, as Bell believes, and as I believe, that the best life, the most intrinsically satisfying life, is a life that's characterized by love and empathy and compassion and relationships that are mutual and positive, if you believe that, then you have an intrinsic motive to seek out that life here and now. If you don't believe it, if you then that's when you presumably need some kind of extrinsic goad to threaten and cajole you into doing what you don't want to do. And I think that's...
Well, yeah, if you don't believe that, or you believe that humans have the capacity for evil as much as they have the capacity for good, right? That's...
Well, I mean, Bell thinks that, and I think, you know, all universalists think that we have the capacity for evil. What Bell argues, what I'd argue, is that if we choose to act on that capacity... there is an intrinsic punishment that just comes from the fact that now we're evil, and that is a bad situation to be in. We're alienated from.
But so if we apply that then to Osama bin Laden, right? I mean, because this is a culturally contingent idea of the good life too. Because if we apply this to Osama bin Laden, you know, he and his followers might argue that they are choosing the good. They are choosing what for them is the good.
Well, I mean, I'm not a cultural relativist about this. I think that, as a matter of fact, if they think that, they're wrong. I mean, that's just...
So is that fanaticism?
No, because I'm not shut off to critically engaging with alternative views about this. And I mean, that's our distinction between fanaticism and
his conviction. No, I'm not intending to defend Osama bin Laden whatsoever, just to set the record straight.
But I think that that Bell's onto something. In other words, when he talks about what we need in order to have a life that is internally meaningful and rich and rewarding, we need to live in a sense of alignment with the good. And if we choose to turn away from that, if we embrace death rather than life, to use that biblical language, then we are embracing our own death rather than our own life, in the sense that we will have an existence that's not really fully alive. And I think that idea, which can be framed in terms of the language of hell, is very powerful and can do what the concept of this hell as this otherworldly state can do. The concept of heaven as an otherworldly state can do.
Yeah, it's a very without some human-centric, of the drawbacks. A very human-centric idea. I mean, it puts all of the emphasis on human agency, on your ability to create your own reality, which I think speaks to a lot of people who don't even identify with the Christian tradition at all. But, you know, I'm curious as to how you see this controversy playing out, because, you know, as we began the conversation with, you know, this kind of perspective has come up throughout American history. This is not at all the first time. And almost every time it's been, you know, subdued or subsumed by the power of voices arguing that, no, we can't take this perspective. This is, you know, first of all, it's not a literal way of reading the Bible. It's dangerous to society. It you know, creates a slippery slope where people can act in any sorts of ways without fear of punishment. This has always been kind of the backlash against this position. So do you think Bell represents a turning point, or do you think that there's going to be a similar kind of backlash? And do you think that the response to bin Laden's death now is part of that?
Well, I mean, I think there's bound to be a backlash to Bell. I don't think the human condition and the controversies that we wrestle with are ever going to make a decisive and final shift in one direction or another. Let me go back to just one point of clarification. The idea that that we can live in heaven now or exist in a hellish state now based on our alignment with the good or alienation from the good, our relationship with God or our being cut off from God, doesn't necessarily entail a humanistic perspective, insofar as one could well believe that the capacity to align oneself with the good in God is limited without the help of God. And I think there's a long tradition of thought which holds that unless we open ourselves up to God just put ourselves at God's feet, we are not going to be able to have the kind of transformation of character that can make possible a genuine living in harmony with the divine here on earth or elsewhere. Getting back to your question about, you know, a notion of a turning point in our thinking about heaven and hell, part of what I think is that while the notion of a hell as this otherworldly punishment can serve as a check on people who have this this generally materialistic or selfish conception of the good, there are real costs to it.
Costs to the real belief in hell, you're saying?
Huh? Belief costs in that kind of otherworldly hell that's an eternal punishment for sin. I think there are real this-worldly costs of belief in that kind of doctrine. I don't know if you, if your research has, if you've explored any of those issues.
Yeah, I have. I have looked at some of that. I mean, I think it's complicated, right? I've looked at, for instance, records of insane asylums where there are, you know, instances where people claim that because they are so afraid of this kind of eternal afterlife of fiery punishment, they essentially went insane. This is an argument that's made in the 19th century. You know, I think obviously scholars today would look at that and say, well, there must have been some underlying biological cause, but I think the fact that they are explaining it as a result of fear is significant, that it shows the psychological costs that hell could sometimes exert in this life. But I think that there's more than just costs. I think that belief in an ultimate eternal state of punishment and an ultimate eternal state of bliss and rewards also had had benefits for the ways in which people lived their daily lives. It's not all about negatives.
Agree with that. I mean that it's not all negative. What mm-hmm. what I'm suggesting is that belief in hell, the positives, in that sense of an eternal hell, the mm-hmm. positives come with a cost, and that those positives can be realized without the costs if we adopt an alternative way of thinking about hell. And I think that this is the kind of alternative that
Rob Bell is Rob Bell is trying to argue for. Yeah, I agree. But I'm not an apologist for either viewpoint as a historian. That's not what I see my job to be. But I think there's something to the ultimateness of eternal punishment and the immediacy, the urgency of trying to save people from it that's functioned as a really powerful motivator in people's lives, both in the past and in the present. You know, and if you look at what kinds of causes people have supported as a result of that, there are definitely causes that we might look at and say, you know, it's horrible that people are viewing, you know, X cause in the light of ultimate punishment. But on the other hand, there are causes that we now look at, like slavery again, and see as actually not, you know, not a horrible result of this urgency, that there needed to be this kind of urgency in order for this to become such an important issue.
But is, I'm not a historian, so I don't know about this, but were the abolitionists generally believers in an eternal hell? Were there abolitionists who were not?
There were definitely abolitionists who were not. You know, William Lloyd Garrison, for instance, in fact, a number of abolitionists turned towards, I think, a position that might be more like Rob Bell's, you know, as their careers went on. But at the same time, they continued to deploy the language of slavery as a national sin, of eternal punishment, of God's wrath coming down upon individuals and upon the nation in order to get the majority of their listeners to understand the urgency of their cause, right? So even if they themselves didn't believe in an eternal hell, they understood that in 19th century America at this time, this was a really powerful concept. And so they spoke the language, right? They adopted the language. That's not to say that, you know, this was the exclusive purview of abolitionists alone. There are Southerners who also adopt this language, you know, who also say that if we, you know, slavery is sanctioned in the Bible, and if we don't support slavery, then we are also going to be damned. So it can be used by both sides, but it's not always just, you know, taken by those who are conservatives or fanatics, I guess I would say.
Right. Now, so, Rob Bell actually speaks favorably at one point in the book about the power of the language of hell that Jesus invokes.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks that the genuine awfulness of certain human choices, the horror, needs to be captured in some kind of sufficiently powerful metaphor, and the language of wailing and gnashing of teeth mm-hmm. fire and such, while powerful, harsh language calls attention, he thinks, to the gravity of the evils that
right, especially with regard to children, I think is the point that he's making.
Now the question is whether one can preserve this powerful rhetorical force of the imagery of hell while moving away from this notion of this pit of fire that the wicked are thrown into mm-hmm. as an eternal punishment for their sinfulness. And part of what I see Rob Bell is doing is trying to, in modern language, make the case for just that sort of ability. There are many others who have sought to preserve some of the rhetorical power of mm-hmm. hell, of that language, within a universalist framework. You can think about it this way. Let's take Osama bin Laden again as an example.
Right.
If you are adopting a fairly traditional Christian theology, you'll think that Osama bin Laden, just like the rest of us, was created in the image of God, mm-hmm. and that there is this essential divine creation that is good, and it's been covered by layers of crud, right? That the ideology and the bitterness and the mean-spiritedness and the righteousness has just buried this under this divine spark, if you will, or whatever, under all of this awful, awful crap. And then bin Laden has identified himself with this crud instead of with that which is of God, and has fully sort of seen himself in terms of this crud. Well, hell can, in this view, be experienced or conceived as Gregory of Nyssa conceived it, as this purging fire mm-hmm. that burns away all those layers of crud to expose that which deserves to be preserved. And Osama bin Laden identifies with the crud, he's going to experience it as the burning of his very self, the destruction
purgatory,
of his very self.
It's a kind of purgation process. Yeah.
Right. But the outcome of this destruction of the self with which he identifies is that there is what remains this self that is of God, right? Mm-hmm. And that and once all that crud is burned away, infant that Osama bin Laden was before any of the horrors that he even contemplated had been done, that child is all that's left, and there is space to start again. Right?
Yeah, what I found interesting, actually, since bin Laden's death and the responses to it have played out, is that there's been some recanting since all the celebration, since all the, Osama's in hell, this is great, let him roast. On Twitter, on Facebook, in the media, too, there have been a number of articles that have come out saying, wait a second, we don't rejoice in death. This is still a life that's been taken.
Right.
And, I've seen some Facebook responses and some Twitter responses saying, let's pray for his soul. So there is, I think, this powerful idea too, that, it's unbecoming of us to take pleasure in the demise of someone, even though that someone was the country's biggest enemy for the last 10 years.
Right. There is an
ultimate kernel of humanity in everyone.
Right. And then there's those who want to say that what I am celebrating is not the death of a human being, but the end of the threat that this human being poses to innocent human lives. And so, I mean, yeah, there's an interesting sort of conversation about our vengeful and retributive feelings, the propriety of celebrating death, even the death of someone like Osama bin Laden, that I think is very interesting that's taking place.
Right. Well, this has been a great conversation.
Yeah, well, I've enjoyed it very much.
So interesting. I think we're just about out of time.
Yep, I think so too.
What with the little blip there in the middle. But
okay.
I so enjoyed this. So on three.
Well, it was my pleasure, and I look forward to seeing what else you have to write on this topic. I think it's a very interesting one.
As do I. I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Okay.
So thanks so much.
Okay.
All right.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.